Hi, it's Shayna here. Before this episode starts, I'm popping in with a quick reminder about our upcoming CEU on Thursday, May 16th, on a person-centered approach to behavior management. School taught us a lot about ABA. However, the thing with ABA is that it's a science and it's constantly evolving. So a lot of what we learned back then doesn't always apply now. Today, we want to use a person-centered approach to behavior management. But what does that look like, and how can our learners still make progress in this kind of approach? So join us live on Thursday, May 16th at 12 p.m. Eastern Time as Shira discusses how to use a person-centered approach to behavior management with your learners. This CEU is presented by our very own Shira Karpal. You can earn one learning CEU for ACE, QABA, or IBAO. Join us live at this event, or to watch the recording asynchronously, go to howtoaba.com/CEU. See you then.
Hi, I'm Shira Karpal.
And I'm Shayna Gaunt, and we're board certified behavior analysts. At How2ABA, we provide practical resources, community, and support to ABA professionals. In each episode of our podcast, we will be having real conversations with real people sharing real stories about ABA.
We'll share relevant strategies and actionable tips that will make us all better ABA practitioners. It's the ABA content you need that you're not going to learn in a textbook.
For our learners who can understand delayed reinforcement, we sometimes use a behavior contract. However, in recent years, our enthusiasm is wavering on a behavior contract. So why don't we love them anymore as much as we used to? So most of us have jobs. I'm assuming that's why you're listening to this podcast. At our jobs, there are rules. There's expectations and guidelines that we're expected to follow. These guidelines may be in the form of written policies, or maybe they're just unwritten rules of behavior. For instance, you know, we know that we have to show up on time and we need to wear something that's half decent to work. We also know that we're supposed to treat clients and colleagues with respect. And, you know, we can go up the hierarchy if we have a complaint. There's a whole bunch of guidelines in place for this.
And something that I'm doing actually currently is providing feedback to some of the people that I manage. And it's similar to behavior contract because sometimes if expectations are vague, it's not really fair either to have expectations and not tell our employees or the people who we have those expectations on what they are, and then also to give them feedback on those expectations. And that's kind of what a behavior contract is, right? Here are the expectations. Let me just tell you what they are so that it's not a secret. Let's be clear about what those expectations are. You know what? Let's even agree on what those expectations are if we can write it together. And then at some point, to be fair, let me give you feedback on how you're doing. Hopefully that feedback is good, but hopefully also the feedback is specific. It's not just you're doing a good job or you're doing a bad job, right? When I do feedback, it's very specific on detailed things because it's not just good or bad, right? We are giving feedback on specifically what those expectations are that we agreed on that are part of this engagement.
Brenda Smith-Miles talks about, you know, unwritten rules, and it's that gray zone, right? Things that, you know, we just expect people to do, but they're not written anywhere. You know, like, you know, when I go into work, you know, I'm expected not to stand on a table and, you know, scream or dance or sing on a table. That would be odd at my work. But, there's nothing written about that in the policies. So, you know, for our learners, sometimes, you know, they don't understand some of these unwritten rules. So behavior contracts can be really great to write down some of these unwritten rules and make things very black and white and very specific.
And it is also important that they are agreements, right? It's not one-sided. I'm not telling you what you need to do, but let's discuss what the expectations are. What is a realistic amount of time, and what might, you know, a reward be or a reinforcer be when you complete your end of the bargain? So, you know, by in an employment contract, it's often, you know, your paycheck is that reward at the end of the contract, or a good reference letter, or whatever it is you're looking out of it, or a good evaluation. For some of our students, it might be something more tangible. So we might say, you know, if you clean your room, then you will get a trip to the ice cream store. But, you know, let's be more specific. If you clean your room, which means you make your bed, it means that there's no clothing on the floor. I'm thinking about my teenage
son.
What else is going on in that room?
Daughter?
but also maybe it needs to be cleaned by 7 p.m. on Thursday because that's when we're having company. And so be specific as to what your expectations are. And then if you meet these expectations, great, you know, let's go for ice cream. So what are behavior contracts? You know, behavior contracts are really guidelines. They're written agreements between a teacher and teacher parent/student. And they're just really the outlined expected behaviors that they're supposed to be doing during a defined amount of time. And then what that reward is if they fulfill their end of the bargain. You know, they're usually put into place after token boards are faded. Students are learning to work for longer and longer periods of time with delayed reinforcement. I would typically put in a behavior contract, you know, if a student's going to school, for instance, and, you know, the teacher can't do a token board all the time, right? But getting the student used to, okay, so here's a defined period of time. It might be circle time or it might be math period or whatever it is. And here's the expectations during that time. Did I raise my hand at least three times? Did I greet the teacher? Did I sit, you know, properly in circle if that's an expectation? You know, did I, you know, look at these math questions? Did I raise my hand for help? Whatever it is, I usually keep it simple. I try and, you know, for 3 to 5 things maximum on that behavior contract. But that's essentially what a behavior contract is. And, you know, the beginning of this podcast, Shira and I, you know, were saying, well, there's downsides to the contract. Well, let's talk about the positives first, because there are a lot of positives to behavior contracts. And then what we'd like to do is point out the downsides and figure out ways to avoid those.
Another really nice positive is that for students that are working towards self-monitoring, a behavior contract gives you the opportunity for more of a reflection, as opposed to a token system where that reinforcement is more immediate and they're dependent on that, you know, that reinforcer to happen right after to reinforce the behavior that happened before. And with a behavior contract, you're encouraging more of a reflection, like how did you do over this half hour time? How did you do during this class? And that can lead to ultimately more self-monitoring, which really is more independent. And it's something I think we all do. We're going to monitor our own behavior.
I am a huge fan of priming, and I really like priming is pre-teaching, and I really like that pre-teaching aspect of it. So, you know, right before I go into a situation, I'm going to, you know, go over the quote unquote rules or guidelines in that situation. And a behavior contract is really nice because those things are written down for the learner, and it's a nice way of priming.
So what are some of the downsides of a behavior contract?
So, you know, all the positives sound really wonderful, you know, like unwritten rules are written down, you're priming, you know, it's, you know, somewhat leading towards self-monitoring, you know, there's reinforcement involved. This is all really, really great. But what if, you know, if we go back to the example of a workplace, for instance, you know, what if our policies at work went into more detail about, you know, behavior and mental health? Like, what if they stated that in order to have, you know, a quote unquote good day, you know, you have to always show up with a smile on your face and you can't voice your opinions, you know, you have to sit properly in circle with your legs crossed at every time. Like, how dare you even like shift a little bit? You know, and if you don't have a quote unquote good day, you can't get your paycheck. Now, I'm really over exaggerating this, but I am really, like, I see the behavior contract and I see so many people using it as, were you a good boy today? Did you have a good day? And I just can't stand that, because the opposite of good means bad. So if you weren't a quote unquote good boy, does that mean you were a bad boy? So how do we define what quote unquote good is, right? You know, we've heard that so many times and I don't know if we can define that. So can we please just get away from the terminology? I could rant about this for ages, but if we can get away from the terminology of like, you know, were you good? Were you bad? Like, I don't love that. So we really do need to reframe that, and taking a look at our day and going, you know, do we have to be the perfect human being? No, like my day is not always perfect, right? So does that mean, you know, because I don't know, shifted in my chair today, I'm not good? Like, I could go off in a whole rant about this. But I think what we need to do is really go, okay, let's look at our day. It's not always perfect. Let's build some room for error in here. And let's get away from using that terminology of good versus bad.
I know, and so often I will go into schools or see a system in place where a teacher will send home a note with the student letting the parent know if they had a good day. And if the child had a good day, then they got some sort of reinforcer at home, which I don't like for many reasons, because I don't want parents to be involved where like they should go home and be able to be parents. But it's very vague. And like Shana was saying, like, we should be allowed to have bad moments. And are we using a behavior contract in a way that still allows for that humanity, for us to experience tough moments, but still not be labeled as a failure?
Another reason that behavior contracts can be a negative is that they're often used as threats. Now, they're not supposed to be. It's supposed to be really positive, like, hey, remember, you only need a few more and then you can have this on your behavior contract. But oftentimes I hear, hey, like, you know, as negative behavior, as the student's starting to escalate or if they're anxious, you know, remember, if you don't do this, then you're not going to get this. And it's just so wrong. So, you know, if you're seeing that behavior contracts are starting to be used as threats, we need to drop that. And we need to give more training around how they really should be used.
Also remembering that for some individuals, having a system that they always need to live up to or in place might be really stressful. And so if you are working with students who are capable of this level of self-reflection or awareness, bringing them into the conversation and asking them if this is something they even want. And it might not be. And we would probably have to respect that. So just considering that this is not something everybody wants. I wouldn't want somebody putting something in place that I didn't want them to be looking at everything I was eating and telling me that that's not something good to eat because it's not healthy. Like, leave me alone, you know? But maybe I do want you looking over my shoulder with something that I'm asking for help in or support in. So thinking about that too.
And often behavior contracts take an all or nothing approach. So, you know, behavior contracts might say, did you meet your goal for today? Yes or no. And then if not, then you don't get what you're working for. So, you know, that student might not meet the goal, but what if the student doesn't meet their goal by 10 a.m.? Like the rest of the day is shot and that student's smart enough to know that. So does that mean they're going to be off track the rest of the day? So, you know, or if it's a whole week and, you know, all or nothing and by Monday they haven't done this, then what's the incentive for the rest of the week? So we really need to be looking at that and going, okay, how can we modify the behavior contract so it's not an all or nothing?
And something that I love in a way to use behavior contracts, and I've been doing a lot more recently, is tying in some intrinsic motivation. The way that we do this often is incorporating some values. So if you're familiar with the ACT model or something like AIM, which actually has a really good point system that's included in the AIM curriculum. But even if not with that curriculum, just incorporating a value. So why are we creating this behavior contract? How is it getting you closer to your value? Is your value to, you know, make more friends? Is your value to get into a certain college or a certain high school? How can we help you get closer to your value and building that intrinsic motivation so that that behavior contract is in line with working towards their values?
And that's huge because that is another default or another downside of the behavior contract. Like if they're working for something that's not intrinsically motivating, it's externally motivating. So if you do this, then you get to go shopping at the end of the week or you get to watch this. They're not doing the behavior because it motivates them to do the behavior. They're doing it for the carrot that's being dangled in front of their face. So we really do need to really look at the behavior contract in general and go, okay, do the upsides, you know, outweigh the downsides? How do we, you know, look at the downsides and can we, you know, have any solutions for these downsides? So what is that answer? Do we stop using behavior contracts altogether? I still use them. I think we could still be using behavior contracts. I think we just need to recognize those downsides and put other things in place to counteract this and really have those conversations with everybody we're working with.
So if you are going to be using behavior contracts, then here are some ways that we would recommend that you do use them. So first is they're not for everybody. So incorporating their consent in putting something like a behavior contract in place and thinking about like, is this really going to help their mental health or state of mind? Maybe not using it with individuals who might be highly anxious.
Number two would be changing your terminology, right? Getting rid of that whole good, bad thing. It's the behavior. It's not the individual. So terminate that behavior right off the bat.
And then not using an all or nothing approach. So it's not like, did I do this yes or no for the entire day? But we could do something more like a rating scale or like how many points towards your goal did you get? So that if they mess up, it's not a failure.
In the downloads, we actually have a behavior contract that has a rating scale. Robert Schramm also in his 7 Steps talks a lot about a rating scale and behavior contracts related to that. But number four would be paying attention to terminology, right? You know, we want to use behavior contracts to motivate, not to threaten. So, hey, look, only a few more and then you'll get this instead of, hey, if you don't do this, then you won't get this.
And remembering that behavior contracts are not a one size fits all. They really should be individualized to each learner. And again, bring them into the conversation and talk with them about how they would want that tailored to their situation.
We want to state contracts using positive terminology. So, you know, keeping your hands to yourself versus saying don't hit. You know, we really want to spell out those terms in simple, positive language, avoid using those negatives like no and don't and not. We can also use me and my and pronouns to make it more personalized as well.
And don't take on too big of a time with a behavior contract. So they could be put in place for short periods of time, especially at first, so that they could be successful. You don't want to put a behavior contract that gets traded in at the end of a week, because who really has a good week? But start by putting it in for half hour periods at a time, maybe an hour, or working up to a day, so that they could be successful and then build up that increment of time.
And as Shira mentioned before, in addition to doing behavior contracts, start to incorporate some ACT with your learner to help them become a bit more intrinsically motivated to meet their goals. Some learners may never become intrinsically motivated, but a lot of other learners will. And once they do, then you can start to fade out the behavior contract altogether.
And so remember, they are meant to be motivating and get kids to want to do their best. And you'll have some sort of way to track that through the data if that's really happening, and review that. If it's not happening, try something else.
So the contract has to be crystal clear with what you're saying. You know, spell out the terms of what the contract is for, you know, using simple positive language, avoiding those negatives. Usually I put in like 3 to 5 pointers. I don't put in like a 10 or 15 rules of behavior. Like, it's just way too much.
Also important to know, if you're going to be putting this in place, you will need to follow through on what you said you were going to deliver. So make sure that it's something feasible and that you're not going to, you know, hold that reward hostage for any other behavior that wasn't part of this behavior contract. If you want the learner to hold up their end of the bargain, then you better definitely hold up your end of the bargain.
With that being said, though, you want to, you know, put in place a behavior contract that you know that the person is going to be successful with, especially at the beginning. This isn't something to try and, you know, point a student out for not doing what they should be doing. It really should be successful. So making sure that you do have that reward and are able to give it.
In summary, today we discussed what behavior contracts are, some of their positives, but also some of their downsides. And we discussed how you can make them better so that you can effectively implement them with your learners.
Thanks for joining today's conversation. Wherever you get your podcast, please go and subscribe, rate and review so others can find out about us too.
For more from How to ABA, including free resources and ABA materials, visit our blog at howtoaba.com. And make sure that you're following us on social media for more practical tips and updates.